despite everything in our polarized world that you might read in the press or on social media, most people are actually pretty nice people. And so they do remember to show that they care personally, but they're so worried about not hurting someone's feelings that they fail to tell them something they'd be better off knowing in the long run. And this mistake I call ruinous empathy.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Crazy Good Turns, the podcast that celebrates and recognizes people who do amazing things for others. I'm your host, Frank Blake, and today I am thrilled to have as our guest, Kim Scott. Kim is an author and a speaker and the founder of a leadership consulting firm. And as if all of that weren't enough, she also once managed a pediatric clinic in war-torn Kosovo and started a diamond-cutting factory in Moscow. She is one interesting person. I'm also particularly thrilled to have her as a guest because I loved her book, Radical Candor. Every once in a while, I read a book that I think hits on a profound truth. Radical Candor is one of those books. The most interesting part of the book for me was her framework for separating radical candor from what she calls ruinous empathy. That is such an important turn of phrase, ruinous empathy. It poses the really tough question of when is empathy too much? Can we worry excessively about hurting someone else's feelings and wind up doing more damage to them and others in the process? Or more often, do we just not invest sufficiently in others to provide them our candid point of view and are actually just more comfortable with ruinous empathy? I enjoyed this conversation with Kim because it is such a difficult topic. And I think, again, a topic of importance both personally and professionally. We care about people. We want to be liked, and it can be very easy to slide into that ruinous empathy category. As Kim explains, though, investing thought and time into helping people improve is itself an important act of generosity. I know it's true for me, it may be true for you as well, that some of the craziest crazy good turns people have done for me have involved very direct and candid feedback. I think you'll hear from the discussion with Kim how her approach to radical candor can help us provide that investment in others that it helps them in a very intentional and productive way. We'll talk to her about that on a professional and personal basis. We'll also talk about the generational differences in giving feedback, and we'll discuss the new realities of interacting with people in this digital age. Most interesting to me, we'll explore Kim's four-box framework for separating radical candor from ruinous empathy. I think you'll find this framework really helpful in exploring the differences between beneficial and counterproductive feedback. Lastly, we'll talk through Kim's latest project, which is about optimism. That's a great topic in itself. And she'll explain why she thinks the class of 2020 might just be able to solve some of the world's toughest problems. I think you'll enjoy this conversation immensely. I know I did. If you want to dig deeper into what Kim has to say, please visit our website. We'll be giving away copies of Kim's Radical Candor book there. Visit crazygoodturns.org and sign up for a chance to win. And now, here's our discussion with Kim Scott.
Thank you, Kim. It is an absolute honor to have you on the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank. The honor is mine. I really admire you as a leader, and I'm excited for this conversation.
So am I. So I love founding stories, and at least I've heard one version of the founding story for Radical Candor. I'm going to start with the question of, did you eventually train your dog to sit?
You know, I did. I did. I, inspired by the stranger on the street of Manhattan who offered me some radical candor, my dog Belvedere did learn to sit.
So for our listeners, would you rewind, give that founding story, and then maybe explain a little bit about yourself and radical candor?
Sure. So the origin story of radical candor happened, and this is important, it happened in the space of time it took a light to change on the street of Manhattan. So this does not have to take a long time. I had just gotten a new puppy, and I adored this puppy. I loved her so much that I had never said a cross word to her. And as a result, she was totally out of control. And so I took her for a walk one night. She's jumping all over the place. She jumped into the street, and I pulled her out of the path of a speeding taxi cab in the nick of time. And I was standing on the street corner with my heart in my throat because my dog had almost just died. And this man, a perfect stranger, looked at me and he said, "I can tell you really love that dog." And, you know, that was sort of all he had to do to open me up to anything else he was going to say, is just to notice my humanity in the moment. But he said to me, "You're going to kill that dog if you don't teach her to sit." And then he pointed at the ground with this kind of harsh gesture and he said, "Sit." The dog sat. I had no idea she even knew what that meant. And I sort of looked up at him in amazement and he said to me, "It's not mean, it's clear." And then the light changed and he walked on, leaving me with words to live by. And I think this really struck me, this moment really struck me as meaningful, in part because I had just become a co-founder and CEO for the first time of a software startup. I had gotten recently an article emailed to me from about 10 or 15 different people at the company. It was a small company. And the article was about how people would rather have a boss who's a total jerk, but really competent, than one who's really nice, but incompetent. And I thought, are they sending me this because they think I'm a jerk or because they think I'm incompetent? And surely those are not my two choices. And as I thought about it, I had gone to business school. I had learned exactly nothing about management at business school. But as I thought about it, one thing I had learned about at business school was a 2x2 framework. And as I thought about that incident with that guy, when he said to me, "I can tell you really love that dog," he was sort of showing me that he cared. He was getting on the same side of the table with me. And then when he said to me, "But you're going to kill that dog if you don't teach her to sit," that was a very direct challenge. So he was caring and challenging at the same time. And that was what I came much later to think of as radical candor.
So for our audience, and I love your book, I love the construct, I love what you're teaching folks, would you summarize for people that 2x2? And particularly how you name each box, which I think is just brilliant.
I'm glad. Thank you. Because it took me like 3 months to come up with this 2x2. My husband thought I had lost my mind because I was like, it was like word salad for a while. So if you think about the vertical line is labeled care personally, and the horizontal line is labeled challenge directly. In the upper right-hand quadrant, where you always want to be, that's radical candor. And it's useful to understand radical candor mostly by understanding what it's not. So sometimes we remember to challenge directly, but we forget to show that we care personally. And I call this obnoxious aggression. That's the bottom right-hand
quadrant.
That's
bottom right-hand obnoxious aggression.
Yeah. And in fact, in an early draft of the book, I labeled that the asshole quadrant because it seemed more clear. But I stopped doing that for a really important reason. I found that when I did that, people would use the 2x2 to start writing names in boxes. And I beg of your listeners, please don't use this framework that way. This is not another Myers-Briggs personality test. Actually, Myers-Briggs was not intended as a personality test. People misuse that too. But anyway, don't use this to label people or to judge yourself. Use this as like a compass to guide specific conversations with specific people to a better place. So if you find yourself in the obnoxious aggression quadrant, try to move up on the care personally dimension.
Right.
But the problem is, I don't know about you, but for me, when I realize I've acted like a jerk, it's not actually my instinct to move up on the care personally dimension. Right. Instead, it's my instinct to go the wrong way on challenge directly. And then I wind up in the very worst place of all, manipulative insincerity. Right? That's the bottom left quadrant. And so if obnoxious aggression is front stabbing, Manipulative insincerity is backstabbing.
Yep.
Manipulative insincerity is where passive aggressive behavior, political behavior, all of the stuff that makes work feel toxic.
I don't really care about you and I'm not going to tell you.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just going to. And sometimes, to be fair, manipulative insincerity, people are afraid. Legitimately afraid. And so it's self-protective. But anyway, this is where the drama happens at work, in obnoxious aggression and manipulative insincerity. If you watch The Office, you're going to see a lot of episodes about these two behaviors. But these are not the most common mistakes that we make. In my experience, and I'd love to hear about your experience, but in my experience, the vast majority of people make the vast majority of their mistakes in this last quadrant, in the upper left-hand quadrant, where they do remember to show that they care personally, because despite everything in our polarized world that you might read in the press or on social media, most people are actually pretty nice people. And so they do remember to show that they care personally, but they're so worried about not hurting someone's feelings that they fail to tell them something they'd be better off knowing in the long run. And this mistake I call ruinous empathy. And that's what I really am determined to stamp out when I wrote Radical Candor, because I struggle with ruinous empathy and, frankly, sometimes with manipulative insincerity myself.
To me, one of the great pleasures of your book, one of the great pleasures of that construct, is that it so immediately hits home. And says, yes, not only do I see that across people, organizations, I see it across myself.
Yeah.
I could say there are instances where I am in each one of those boxes and I understand that radical candor, how hard it is to get there and how intentional and thoughtful you have to be to get there. And I'd love to talk a fair amount about the ruinous empathy, but maybe first some comments around radical candor and what you found people's willingness to take that on, some of the struggles with it, and what you found as you coach and lead teams.
I think the most common reason that we fail to be radically candid is that we want to be nice to people. And I want people to want to be nice. Like, that's a good thing. We don't want to lose that. And so I think that the thing that really helped me more than anything else move towards radical candor. So let's assume that I'm over there in ruinous empathy. The thing that helps me sort of overcome, because, you know, I said it's fast. That conversation on the street corner was very fast, but it takes a lot of emotional discipline. So what can get, and that for most of us is in short supply. So the thing that helped me get over that hump was to tell a story about ruinous empathy and what happened and to sort of label that story. And that's what helped me move towards radical candor more than anything else. You want me to lay the story on you, or you got another
call? Yeah, no, that'd be fascinating. Let's get the story. Yeah.
So here is the story. I had just hired this guy, and we'll call him Bob. And I liked Bob a lot. He was smart. He was funny. He was charming. He would do stuff like, one time we were at a manager offsite, and we were playing one of those endless get-to-know-you games that everybody secretly hates.
Right.
Bob was the guy who had the courage to raise his hand and to say, I can tell that everyone is really stressed out and I've got an idea. It'll be really fast. Whatever his idea was, if it was fast, we were down with it. He says, this is really going to help us. This is really going to help us get to know each other. And he said, let's just go around the table and confess what candy our parents used when potty training us. Really weird, but really fast. Weirder yet, everyone remembered. And then for the next 10 months, every time there was a tense moment in a meeting, Bob would whip out just the right piece of candy for the right person at the right moment. So Bob brought a little levity to the office. Yeah. One problem with Bob, he was doing terrible work. I was so puzzled because he had this incredible resume. I learned much later the problem was that Bob was smoking pot in the bathroom 3 times a day, which maybe explained all that candy that he had on hand. And all time. But I didn't know any of that at the time. All I knew is that he would hand stuff into me and there was shame in his eyes. He knew it wasn't nearly good enough. And I would say something to him along the lines of, oh, Bob, This is a great start. You're so awesome. We all love working with you. Maybe you can make it just a little bit better, which, of course, he never did. So why did I do that? Part of it was truly ruinous empathy. I really did like Bob, and I really didn't want to hurt his feelings. But if I'm honest with myself, there was something more insidious going on as well, because Bob was popular, and Bob was sensitive. And there was part of me that was afraid if I told Bob, in no uncertain terms, that his work wasn't nearly good enough, that he might get upset, even start to cry. And then everyone would think that I was a big you-know-what. And so the part of me that was worried about my reputation as a leader was the manipulative insincerity part. And the part of me that was worried about Bob's feelings, that was the ruinous empathy part. And this goes on for 10 months, and eventually the inevitable happens. And I realized that if I don't fire Bob, I'm going to lose all my best performers. Because not only have I been unfair to Bob, not telling him because I haven't given him time to fix it, I've been unfair to the whole team.
Right.
They're frustrated. Their deliverables are late because his deliverables are late. They're not able to spend as much time on their work because they're having to redo his work. And the best performers are fed up. They're going to go someplace where they can do their best work. And so I sat down to have a conversation with Bob that I should have started, frankly, 10 months previously. And when I finished explaining to him where things stood, he kind of pushed his chair back from the table. He looked me right in the eye and he said, "Why didn't you tell me?" Yeah. And as that question is going around in my head with no good answer, he looked at me again and he said, "Why didn't anyone tell me? I thought you all cared about me." And now I realized that by not telling Bob, thinking I was just being nice, I'm having to fire him as a result of it. Not so nice after all. And it was one of the worst moments of my career. It was terrible for me. It was much worse for Bob. It was bad for the whole team. And it was bad for our ability to get results. We weren't getting results as a result. So it was bad emotionally. It was bad practically. And yet it was too late to say Bob. Even Bob at this point agreed that he should go because his reputation on the team was just shot. And all I could do really in the moment was make myself a very solemn promise that I would never make that mistake again, and that I would do everything in my power to help other managers avoid making that mistake, because it is, frankly, the most common management mistake that people make.
Absolutely. What I love about that story and also the construct is that I thought you all liked me
and
therefore would invest in me
with
your views of how I'm doing. And I have long thought that that construct you set out is one of the great, is a framework of thinking about generosity.
Yes.
And it was one of the reasons, frankly, I was so thrilled to have you on this podcast, because our purpose is to celebrate people who do great things for others. And I think that's an essential thing that people do for others, is they help them succeed.
Yes.
And sometimes, very often, the best way to help them succeed is you take some risk on your own shoulders by weighing in and saying, "Hey, this just isn't working," whatever it is.
You know, I love that you said that. And I'm having this sort of eureka moment, because for the last 5 years, 6 years, I have been talking about this as an investment. You know, and it's not, and it's an act of generosity. That's a much better way to think about it than an investment. Because you are, as a leader, often it feels like a sort of a very lonely one-way street. You're giving, you're giving, you're giving.
Right.
And yet, that is also the joy of being a leader. When you're able to take pleasure in other people's success.
Right.
Even if it doesn't help you in some sort of practical way, that's really, it's a big part of the joy of living, isn't it?
Absolutely. There's another topic, related topic, that I'd love to get your point of view on. As I've told you, Kim and I had this conversation before we started the podcast, but I always reference your work. I think it's terrific. I urge all of our listeners to buy your books and listen to your podcast, because they're great. What I have noticed in the last, what I'd say is sort of post-pandemic time period, is the upper left-hand quadrant, ruinous empathy, now gets a lot more attention conceptually than the upper right-hand quadrant on radical candor. And I put that down to people struggling generationally and both sides. But the number of folks who've said to me, gosh, I have a very tough time. I feel like I'm working with people who really don't want candid feedback and affirmatively resist it. And I'm curious whether you're seeing that and whether you see that with the folks you work with.
Yeah, this is a really important question, I think. And I have a theory, and I hope you'll be radically candid in pushing back on my theory. So my theory is that it is the job of the younger generation, and this has been true for all of human history, but it is the job of the younger generation to challenge the older generation. And so when you are a leader, your main job is actually to solicit feedback before you give it. Yep. And to act on it, to reward the candor. Because when someone who's younger tells you something that you're doing wrong, points out a better way of doing things, that is an act of generosity on their part.
Yeah.
Even though it sometimes is delivered in a way that doesn't seem so. Maybe it's delivered in an obnoxiously aggressive way.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's delivered in a self-righteous shaming kind of way. But when you get that feedback, then it is your job not to criticize the criticism and the way it was delivered, but to listen to what you're being told. And it's my experience that when you do that, then the people who are working for you are wide open to feedback. I mean, I developed these ideas for radical candor when I was working at Google and managing sort of 700 recent college grads. These young people who had recently graduated from college really craved the feedback, but I needed to earn the right to give it by listening to it before I gave it out. And this it was an interesting place to be talking about empathy and compassion because I don't really associate those traits with the military, but it turns out the military is better at teaching these things than just about anybody. But I was at West Point and we were talking about leadership and followership and how important it is. You know, there's a lot of training on how to be a great leader. There's not nearly as much training on how to be a great follower. And the responsibility of a follower is to give feedback to the leader. But that can only be safe if the leader has created the conditions where it makes sense for people to give them feedback, where it is received as a gift and not as something to be punished. And so it's the job of the leader to solicit feedback, the job of the follower to give feedback, and then they get to switch. But as an order of operations, I think that's an interesting way to look at it. I think there is something new, however, with this generation, which is the communication tools that it has at its disposal. Right. And I think that there's more fear from leaders about giving feedback to their employees than I think was present even 10 years ago.
I think you've set out a very good framework for responding to that. But a related question is radical candor in the age of Zoom calls and remote work, where there are any number of instances where something that you might have said in an office that would disappear and everybody, the person was grumpy or whatever on that day, now becomes
part of the permanent record.
And it does have this impact of, wow, I've got to be very careful about what I say and how I say it.
Yeah, it has a silencing impact. Yeah. I mean, I think that on a Zoom call, if you don't record the Zoom call, then it's just like any other meeting.
Right.
And so I think in general, it's a good idea not to record everything that you do. I know that sometimes someone can't be present, so you're tempted to record it. I also think that the things that get in the way of these radical candor moments, because it's largely delivered in these impromptu conversations, the things that get in the way in person actually are the same things that get in the way in a hybrid or a remote world. So one of the most common reasons that people give for not being able to give feedback in the moment is that there isn't a moment. You know, you're scheduled back to back to back. And that was true in person as well. I mean, that's actually not a new problem. At least I don't think so. And so what I said in the book is you either need to create some slack time in your schedule and make all your hour-long meetings 50 minutes and all your half an hour meetings 25 minutes so that A, there's time for feedback, but you also might need to go to the bathroom or get a cup of tea, and those things are important too. But even then, even when I did that, there was a problem. And the problem was if I went up to someone at the end of the meeting and I said, will you walk back to my office with me? It was sort of like being summoned to the principal's. I would text the person and I would say, can you walk back to my office with me? And I would do it towards the end of the meeting so they weren't nervous the whole time. And then we would walk. And the same thing is true over Zoom. If you notice something in a Zoom meeting that is problematic, you want to text the person towards the end of the Zoom meeting and say, can we hop on a call? And it's very interesting. There's a lot of evidence that shows that a phone call is better than a video call. Actually, a phone call may be better than an in-person meeting. So if you're in person, I would say take a walk. Don't sit across from the table from each other, because that can feel sort of confrontational. And a video call has kind of the same impact. It's like we're not on the same side of the table. We're looking at each other. So pick up the phone and call the person in between your meetings. Just create these little spaces. I think, and remember that you want to praise in public, criticize in private.
Right.
But there's also a fine line, I think, between criticism and debate. Debate obviously has to happen in public. And that's where the phenomenon that you're talking about can trip us up, because people are afraid, for example, to interrupt each other. And in particular, I find they're reluctant to interrupt women because they're afraid, men are afraid to interrupt, but we have to have this kind of give and take in our conversation. And there's a fine line between being aware of the problem of interrupting too much and never interrupting, right?
Right, right. Exactly. I'm curious, because it's such an obvious bridge to cross, whether people ask you, okay, I understand the construct and work, I can think about how I do this better at work, but the same concepts apply in personal life.
Yeah, 100%.
And how you think about that is when people say, Kim, how should I translate these same concepts personally?
You know, I would not be married right now if it weren't for radical candor. I'll tell you a story. I was just starting to date the man who's now my husband, and I like to do yoga in the morning. And one morning I was doing yoga and he came and he sat down on the couch and started reading the paper. And I was like, I had this moment where I didn't want to say anything because it seemed sort of rude or whatever. But I was like, I never want to see this person again, because I don't want someone in the room with me. And I was like, why can't I just tell him to go in the other room and read his paper? And I did. And then we were able to have another date. So I think, yes, that's a long-winded way of saying yes. It applies in romantic relationships. It applies with life partners. It applies with kids. And in many ways, it's easier in our personal life. It can be easier because it's easier for me to show my children and my husband that I care about them. You know, I can go up and give them a big old hug.
Right, right.
And they know that I love them, I hope. And so in some ways that makes it much easier. But I will also say all of us probably have a couple of long-standing relationships where in the tech sector, we talk about technical debt. I think in our relationship, sometimes we develop feedback debt.
Yeah.
and there's a mountain of stuff to get through until you can have these impromptu 2-minute conversations like the guy on the street with my dog. And in those cases, you need maybe difficult conversations or, you know, one of those you're having conversations that are going to feel more like a root canal, and you got to get through that in order to get to these 2-minute impromptu radical candor conversations that are more like brushing and flossing. That's like a root canal.
So we'll go back for a second on your labeling of the four blocker, because I think it is so brilliant, but particularly ruinous empathy, because those aren't obvious terms to put together.
Yes.
What got you to that term, and what were you seeing as the results of empathetic behavior that led you to that?
So it would be interesting to pull up. I have probably 1,000 different words that were combinations that I was trying. Yeah. One of them was cruel empathy, because it was accidentally, you weren't intending to be cruel. Right. Another one was like paralytic empathy, because sometimes I feel paralyzed by my, I consider myself kind of an empath, and sometimes my empathy can paralyze me, can prevent me from actually helping a person. So like an extreme example is if you were to be purely empathetic, if you walk past someone and you saw them drowning and you're 100% empathetic, then you yourself can't breathe and it's hard for you to help them, right? And so those were some of the things that I was considering. And in fact, I really loved calling it cruel empathy. And my husband gave me feedback, no, that's not right. He's an engineer and very precise. And he's like, because cruelty implies intention.
Yeah.
And and obviously the intention is not there. And then I was coaching Jack Dorsey when he was leading Square, before he was also leading Twitter. And he offered to read the book, and he looked at it and he said, I will not read anything about cruel empathy. It sounds like a Harlequin romance. And so between my husband and Jack Dorsey, they convinced me to keep thinking. And then I was debating this with another writer, Gretchen Rubin, who wrote The Happiness Project, and she just came out with a new book called The Five Senses. And I think she was the one who suggested ruinous empathy. So it took a lot of feedback. I was lucky. I had a lot of feedback from a lot of great thinkers about ruinous empathy.
The other phrase that comes up is a path to ruin. You're setting yourself up.
Yeah.
A path to ruin.
Yes. I mean, I think if we go back to that Bob story.
The Bob story.
Like, not only was I ruining my relationship with Bob and ruining his relationship with his colleagues and ruining his colleagues' experience at work and therefore my relationship with the other people on my team, I was ruining our ability to achieve the results that you know, we were not able to execute on our mission. And so it was ruinous both to our relationships but also to our results. And it was a contributing factor in that startup's failure. And that was kind of what I was trying to capture with the word ruinous. It was bad, 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 bad all the way down.
It seemed to introduce a bit of a moral dimension to this, as well as utilitarian. So it's not just what it does with the results. It is actually just, there is some obligation to the people we care about to actually tell them, hey, this isn't working very well.
Yeah. In fact, one of the things I say about radical candor is that if you really care about your colleagues, it's your moral obligation to listen to their feedback to you and also to give your feedback to them. So I think there's multiple different levels of this. There's an emotional level, there's a moral level, and there's a practical level. And they're all really important. One doesn't detract from the other. They all feed on one another.
Well, I think, as I said, I there's so much wisdom in your book and so much practical advice. It also leads to another question. I look at your career, and you've done a lot of different things, from starting up a software company to working in Kosovo. I mean, wow, that just that, having a clinic in Kosovo, building a diamond cutting factory in Moscow.
Yes.
Is there a common theme that's running through here that drives this experience and wisdom?
I think that part of it is my whole business career in some aspects was just a giant plan to subsidize my novel writing habit. But I think like all of it began probably when I was about 10 years old and I read The Diary of Anne Frank. And I made myself, there's these things that happen to us as children. I made myself a very solemn promise that if I were ever in a situation where genocide was happening, that I wouldn't do nothing, that I wouldn't do nothing. And I think that is part of what led me to go to Kosovo, because this was in 1999, and it was right as NATO was bombing the Serbian position there. And almost the whole population of Kosovo had fled the country. And then they were coming back. And that was the reason for the clinic. I think also part of, and this I kind of wrestled with much more in my next book, but part of what was going on when I made that promise to myself as a child was that I was white growing up in Memphis. And there was, you know, real evil happening in the South. I mean, I was born in 1967, so things had gotten better, but they were, the racial tension in Memphis was by no means resolved. And I think I was in denial about that was probably the real thing that was in my mind, is how could we do such evil things? And I think that was part of why I was interested in college. I studied Russian literature, and I was interested in preventing nuclear war, and which would that was the thing we were really afraid of then. We didn't understand climate change, but I think that it was, you know, it was important to me to sort of understand humanity is so inspiring, and our ability when we collaborate, like there's no great thing we can't accomplish. But also when we seek to coerce one another, there's no horror we can't sink to. And trying to understand, like, what are the systems that we can create so we can do more of the inspirational things and fewer of the really horrible things is what was interesting to me about management. And I think it was these diamond cutters who I had to hire in Moscow, who sort of taught me that that management was part of the solution there. I thought, you know, I had studied Russian literature. I knew nothing about business, and I was sent off to Moscow to hire these diamond cutters. And I was like, well, wow. How hard could that be? Like business,
I don't know. That sounds pretty challenging.
Business is easy. You pay people, right? And the ruble was collapsing, and the dollar was strong. And so I thought, oh, how hard could this be? I'm going to offer them, you know, 100 times their salary. Of course they're going to take it, but they didn't take the job. And they said what they wanted was a picnic. I was like, well, you know, I can do a picnic too. And so we're out in the outskirts of Moscow having this picnic and drinking a bottle of vodka. And by the time we get to the end of the bottle of vodka, I realized that the thing that I had to offer, that the state where they had worked previously did not have to offer, was not money. It was that I cared enough to get them and their families out if things went sideways in Moscow, wow, in Russia. And as you can imagine, I've been thinking a lot about those folks since Russia invaded Ukraine.
Wow, that's fascinating. Now, another personal question. So your business is doing great. You've got other people who work on your podcast. I assume you've got a lot of people who work for you that do the training. What do you now apply your time to?
I am working on a novel, and the novel is about the high school class of 2020, and then it's going to fast forward to 2070, and they will have fixed everything. And the reason I'm working on this novel
is that... Oh my gosh, you're an optimistic person.
Yes. Well, you know, I grew up in the 70s, and that was kind of an optimistic decade. Yeah. And my kids are growing up. I have twins who are 14, and they are not so optimistic about the future. And so I think it was very useful. I think optimism is a very useful, yeah. I mean, you want to be realistic as well, but I think it is important to have some optimism about the future. So that's what I'm trying to offer my children. And then the other thing that I'm working on with the Radical Candor team is to figure out how to teach management. I kind of mentioned in passing that I went to business school and I learned nothing about management. I think all of us had to learn the hard way how to be a good boss, a good manager, a good leader. And we can talk about those three words. And the problem with that is that, you know, not only did I have to learn the hard way, Bob had to learn the hard way, and my whole team had to learn the hard way, and my investors, you know, wound up losing a bunch of money because I was learning the hard way and the slow way. And so I'm trying to think about what we could do differently to teach people faster. I think to a certain extent, management is a learning by doing thing, but surely we can help folks learn faster.
I think that's absolutely true. I'll be fascinated to hear what you come up with on that, because I do think it's a skill set that can be taught. So I always ask on the podcast, I always ask folks, what is a crazy good turn that someone did for you? So other than the person on the street telling your dog to sit, what's a crazy good turn that someone has done for you, Kim?
Early in my career, when I was working in Moscow, I was being paid dramatically less than the men, my peers who were men, like not just 25% less, but like 75% less, a lot less. And there was corporate housing there because it was illegal for Americans to rent apartments. And it was grandiose. It was this mansion that had been built for the generals who won World War II. So it was a grandiose corporate. And then the CEO decided that it was inappropriate, that Russia was a sexist society, and it was inappropriate for a woman to live there. And so he said, just go and, you know, get an illegal sublet in Moscow. And a few other things had happened that were like dramatically unfair. But I was sort of gaslit by this whole thing. And there was another partner who pulled me aside and he just said, it's not fair. I tried to fix it. I can't fix it, but it's not fair. He was sort of an upstander. That really threw me a lifeline, because I was sort of sinking into this feeling of depression and like, could I succeed in business as a woman? And so I wrote a book called Just Work to really, and part of the goal of that book is to help empower upstanders to stand up more often, because they play such a vital role in creating better work environments.
That's fantastic. That is terrific. And do you keep in touch with him?
I do. We had a conversation a few months ago, and I told him how grateful I was.
Does he even, I mean, sometimes
he,
on those things,
no, he barely even remembered.
It never even registered. It's a great lesson for all of us, how things that you do can be so impactful to others.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure the man on the street doesn't remember either that incident.
Exactly.
And I think that's a kind of an inspiring note to end on about generosity.
Exactly.
We could, just by noticing another person's humanity in the moment, that is an act of generosity that can change that person's life.
So well said. Brilliant. Thank you so much, Kim, for your time. And I urge everyone who listens to this podcast, go out and buy your books and listen to your podcast. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Really enjoyed the conversation.
I hope you found that an interesting and challenging discussion. If you enjoyed today's conversation with Kim, please go to crazygoodturns.org. There you'll find show notes from today's episode, and you can sign up for your chance to win her book, Radical Candor. That is, again, crazygoodturns, all one word, .org. Please also support our show by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the podcasting platform of your choice. And please leave us a like or a comment there too. As always, I want to thank the team that makes Crazy Good Turns possible. Our producers, Brian Sabin and Megan Hanlon, editing and mixing by Score, and Leslie Nunn for keeping this operation going forward. Lastly, I want to express my gratitude to you, our listeners, for being part of a community that celebrates people who do good things for others. Your giving of your time to listen to these interviews and acknowledge these good deeds is a crazy good turn all of its own. Thank you for your help. I hope to see you again soon in our next episode when we celebrate another crazy good turn. Thank you.